What is up, cyber and crypto friends? Today is September the 5th of 2024. This is episode number 118 of the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. All the views and opinions on this podcast are solely my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of my employer. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at CyberCryptoGuy. All right, so some of the topics today I want to talk about are single sign-on and some of the pros and cons there, and also some identity security tips and tricks. And then on the crypto side of things, there's some news about Ripple and their new stablecoin that's coming out. And of course, we'll talk about the recent price fluctuations of Bitcoin and the entire market and all that kind of fun stuff. So to kick it off here, let's start with single sign-on. So there was some interesting banter a few weeks ago that I had with some people regarding single sign-on, and they were very much against single sign-on from a security perspective. Their argument was that single sign-on provided, you know, a single place for a hacker to gain access to all of your internal applications. And yes, that is 100% accurate and true. If the account is compromised and it's tied to single sign-on, then whatever apps that user has access to that was compromised, now the bad guys have access to those. So in that aspect, yes, single sign-on can be a little risky. However, I think single sign-on is one of those things where security and convenience kind of marry a little bit, in my opinion. I think it's better for security in a few different ways. Number one, single sign-on allows you to have effectively a single authentication policy. So meaning you can set your password length, you can set your multi-factor settings, you know, all those kinds of fun things through your identity provider, whether that's Azure or Okta or Ping or whoever you're using, doesn't really matter. But you can set all those things and have a single source of authentication, basically. And that single authentication source, again, is your authentication policy, basically. So that is a positive, right? Because if you think about it, not all sites have very good password policies, right? The site may only require a 8-character password or something crazy, right? So is that really what you want across your enterprise? And they may not support multi-factor or all the different types of multi-factor, right? So to me, that's benefit number one. Centralized authentication, authentication policy, password length, multi-factor requirements, all that kind of good stuff. And additionally, you can think about user provisioning. Oftentimes, when you don't have a single sign-on solution and you're either provisioning or deprovisioning a new hire or someone's leaving the company, you have to log into every application and create an account and have them set it up. And then they've got all these separate passwords and things like that. But you know, how easy is that for the end user? Well, it's not. And you can imagine they're probably going to reuse the same password, right? And then do all of those sites require multi-factor? These are all the things you got to consider. And so on the, you know, the flip side of that, password reuse, right? If you don't have single sign-on, users are going to use the same password. And those sites may, you know, require a password change every month, every 6 months, every year. So they may have different password change timelines. And so then your end users are, you know, trying to remember or, you know, using slight variations of the same password for every single one of these applications. So in that aspect, single sign-on helps your end users not have to remember a whole bunch of passwords and or reuse a whole bunch of passwords, right? Or the same password, I should say. And, you know, they have a single place that they can go to log into all these applications. With single sign-on, you get a page, a web page full of little tiles that you can click on that then log you into the application that you're trying to access, right? Versus, you know, having to bookmark a ton of URLs and fun things like that. Then your users end up storing passwords in their browser, potentially, if you don't have a password manager, you know, fun things like that, where you just really, you can really save a lot of headache for the end user. You can save a lot of headache for you if you're provisioning and deprovisioning, right? Because when people leave, you then have to log into every single application and delete or disable those accounts when that person leaves, and you may forget one, right? Where if it's single sign-on, though, you disable their account in, you know, Okta or Azure or whatever it is, and then they can no longer access any of those single sign-on apps, right? So that's where it makes it a whole lot easier, right, for the end user and for the administrator, really. I think the other security benefit is centralized logging of authentication, right? So in the event that someone's account does get compromised and you're using single sign-on, sure, the bad guys can get to, you know, all these different single sign-on applications. However, at least you would know which applications they got into, right? So in a lot of cases, you may not be, you know, sending logs from every single SaaS application to your SIM. So you may not have all the authentication from all those applications, you know, logging to your SIM. Whereas if you have single sign-on, you would have all that authentication logging to your SIM. So that's also where it helps for, you know, triage, for, you know, remediation efforts, all those kinds of things. Now, some might say, well, if they don't have single sign-on, they may only compromise one application. Okay, sure, that's true. But how are you going to know? That's the problem. If you don't have logs from all those applications, how are you going to know, right? And so if you can forward logs from every single application that you have, every SaaS platform that you have, that's great. But in a lot of cases, that's going to increase your cost for your SIM and, you know, to store all those additional logs, right? And so that's additional parsing, that's additional SIM work you're going to have to do. Whereas, again, if it's all centralized, it makes it a little bit easier. So the centralized logging, centralized authentication, centralized password policies and MFA and all that kinds of things, then just ease of onboarding and offboarding and provisioning and deprovisioning. It just makes it a lot easier, a lot smoother. And, you know, I've been in organizations that don't use single sign-on. And when you get hired, it's like, oh, you need access to that? Oh, hold on. Let me go give you access. Oh, you need access to that too? Oh, hold on. Let me go log into that. And so it's much easier when your new hires, they can, you know, start on day one and they've already got access to all the applications that they need. Wouldn't you prefer them to have what they need when they start rather than, hey, boss, I don't have access to these five different tools. You know, can you get me access? Oh, yeah, sure. Hold on. And that's just additional work that you can save yourself a ton of time, a ton of headache. And it's ease of use, right? It makes it easier for the end users, easier for the admins, all that kind of fun stuff. So also too, for the like incident response side of things, you can think about when somebody's account does get compromised, you can basically kill all the active sessions through your IDP, which would effectively, at least hopefully, sign them out of all those single sign-on sessions, right? That's the goal, at least. So in that case, that could really help you too for incident response kind of things, right? So there are some, I think the benefits, the security benefits outweigh the, you know, the negatives or the cons with single sign-on. But, you know, I guess it all depends on, you know, your organization, right? Do they, and also too, you got to remember this SSO tax that everybody just absolutely loves when, you know, various SaaS vendors, they want to charge you more for single sign-on. Basically for no apparent reason. And that's where, you know, an organization may not have the funds to have single sign-on, right? So also want to mention that with a single sign-on platform, you can require an additional multi-factor step for specific applications. So let's say you're using Ping Identity, right? Or even CyberArk or whatever, it doesn't matter. If you're using one of these IDPs for single sign-on and you create an app that's, let's say it's your accounting application, right? Let's say it's like NetSuite or SAP or whatever. And you know, don't trust anybody and you want to make sure that you have to multi-factor a second time just to get into that application. So the user would go to their single sign-on IDP provider page. They would log in with their password, with their multi-factor, and that would get them signed in to see all the applications they have access to, right? Where they can click all the various tiles. And then, for example, if you had NetSuite or QuickBooks, whatever it is, doesn't matter, and you said, I want an additional multi-factor step for this application, when they click on QuickBooks or NetSuite or SAP, it will then prompt them a second time for multi-factor. And also, if you really wanted to get, you know, super granular with it, you could require a YubiKey for specific applications, right? So they could MFA into your SSO provider, and then to get into your super sensitive applications, well, now you have to have a YubiKey, right, to authenticate to SAP or NetSuite or whatever it is. So you can really, you know, I think that you can almost negate the idea of, oh, they're going to get access to all the applications if they compromise an account. Yes, they're going to get access to a ton of them, but if you have additional multi-factor steps there, they may not get access to them. All right, so that's just kind of some of the single sign-on fun stuff that I was debating with somebody about the other day. So again, it just depends on your org, but I think it's more security benefit than there is negative. But also to tie into that a little bit, I think account security or identity security is really something that, you know, IAM is just massive. And there's a lot of organizations that don't always realize that, like, for example, if you create an account in Active Directory, that, oh, that account's going to sync to Azure. Well, wait a second. You start creating test accounts and, you know, service accounts that you're using just locally, internally, and you think it's all internal, but you're actually creating an external attack surface by creating these test accounts and service accounts, because all of that syncs up to Azure. And then you've now got an external account that you may not log into it from the Azure side. So then you may never set up MFA in some cases for those accounts. So the identity security is extremely, you know, important in multiple different ways. That's also why, you know, single sign-on and identity security kind of go hand in hand, right? With multi-factor, single sign-on, authentication policies, all that kind of fun stuff. And, you know, I think that there can be a lot of things overlooked when it comes to, you know, identity security. So all I can say is be very cautious when creating test accounts and service accounts and things like that. If you absolutely have to create these accounts, make sure that on the Azure side, or I guess it's Intra ID now, on that side of things, you create geofencing policies or you create IP restrictions so that these accounts can only log in from specific, you know, public IP addresses, for example, or specific countries or locations, whatever it is. Try to limit the scope of where that account can be used as much as you possibly can. And then if that account is attempting to be used anywhere outside of that, of course, it'll get blocked, which is great. So just think about like conditional access policies that you can apply. So really, I think that conditional access, you know, for especially for your administrator accounts, those kinds of things should be very, very well fine-tuned in Azure or Intra ID so that you have, you know, enhanced multi-factor setup, you've got all the risk detections set up, you've got, you know, good password policies for those administrative accounts, you've got geofencing where they can only log in from certain areas. And that's just on the admin side. Now for end users, I think that there's an opportunity to geofence those end users to their home country, at least. I guess you could go as far as going by state, but I think that could get a little hairy since the IP addresses aren't always super duper perfect. However, you know, I think that at least geofencing them to, you know, their home country, like the United States, for example, could really help with the initial account compromises. A lot of times what I've seen, at least in my experience, when a user gets a phishing email and they click the link, that phishing site is typically hosted in some other country. So if you're geofenced to the United States and you've got some sort of phishing site up and you're trying to, and they capture your credentials or whatever, maybe they're passing your credentials through to the actual Microsoft Office website, for example, they could, or that login, you know, if they're passing those credentials through, that login would show it's coming from outside the United States in a lot of cases, depending on how the phishing attack is set up, right? But, you know, we've seen phishing attacks where they're phishing your MFA code, all that kind of fun stuff, especially if you're using SMS or a six-digit code. Those things can be phished, you know, using these pretty sophisticated phishing sites where they basically, you know, have a little frame that passes the credentials that you put in directly to the legitimate site that they're trying to capture credentials for. But they're passing those credentials from a location that's typically outside of the United States, right? So a lot of the initial account compromises can be mitigated by just geofencing to the end user's home country, like the United States, or if they primarily work in Canada or whatever it is, it doesn't matter, just geofence them to that location and then create a travel notification policy for your entire organization and just let folks know, like, hey, if you're going to travel outside of the United States, just let us know. You can just, you know, put in a ticket, be as simple as that, and then tell us where you're going so that we know we can geofence you to that location, assuming, of course, that that end user needs to access company resources while they're in whatever other country. So, you know, the geofencing can really, really help. But, you know, oftentimes I think that when people are on vacation, they need to be on vacation, right? We don't need to allow this for, you know, people to work while they're on vacation, right? So if you're going on vacation out of the country, go on vacation, take the time off. We're going to block, you know, all access, as we should, right? But if they absolutely need to work from outside the country that they live in, then okay, sure, put them in an exception conditional access policy where they can log in from whatever country that they're traveling to. So now that can get a little tedious administratively, as you can imagine, if you have a lot of people that travel for business or whatever it is, but you could create, you know, separate conditional access policies that apply to, you know, like salespeople may be traveling out of the country a ton. So you may put them in their own conditional access policy where it allows them to travel to all the countries that your business does business in, right? If it's all of the UK and Canada and Mexico and United States, okay, cool. Then geofence them to that, right? Just for salespeople. But for like accounting people or HR, or they're in, you know, one particular city or state in the United States, well, then geofence them to the United States, right? So you can always create separate conditional access policies depending on, of course, the circumstances of the employee and where they travel and fun stuff like that. So that can reduce the administrative burden, if you will, especially for like salespeople that may be traveling abroad. So anyway, that's kind of my spiel for the cybersecurity side of things today. I did want to talk about our good old friend Bitcoin and how horrible it's doing. It's interesting, when the Fed decided to lower interest rates a little bit, all of a sudden Bitcoin price went down. So how those are tied together, I'm still not really sure. All of it seems very weird, but the price did take quite the dip. You know, we were floating around 60, 63, 65 in that region. And now today we're all the way down to 56,000. So definitely way down from where it was. Ethereum's at 2366. So overall, you know, the markets are in the red primarily, but this may actually be a good opportunity for buying. I'm a little hesitant personally. I still feel like there should have been a much bigger bull run on Bitcoin. And now I'm questioning if that bull run's ever actually going to happen, because I think it probably should have already happened by now. So yeah, much past another month or two, I don't know that there's actually going to be a bull run. We may have seen the peak this year at 72 or 3,000, whatever it was. Regardless, I think that there's still, you know, some opportunities if you're really, really advanced in the crypto space and you see, you know, new tokens being spun up and stuff like that. Like they have so many meme tokens now, it's quite ridiculous. But if you can catch that wave and ride it correctly, then you can certainly make some money off of that. I just think it's very hit or miss, and you have to be very, very good at what you're doing to really cash in on that. Now, if you're risk averse, at least you can, if you're using like Coinbase, for example, you can make 5.2% interest just by holding USDC at Coinbase. So that makes it kind of nice. Or you can, of course, do staking with other cryptos like Polygon and what's the other one? Stellar or Atom. I forget what it's called, but there are Ethereum too, of course. But it's funny, and even Solana. But Ethereum, their staking percentage right now, I think you're only getting like 2%, which is not great. But Polkadot, I think you're getting, you know, upwards of 10 to 12% APY. And those fluctuate, right? Depending on the market and all that. And depending on how many people are actually staking, I think that rate goes down if there's more people staking. Solana right now is at 5.24%. But again, when you're staking your crypto, you're locking it into that particular blockchain, and you cannot get it out super quickly, right? So when the markets start crapping out like they have over the last few weeks, you basically have to wait. And so this is where staking can be a detriment in some cases. Yeah, you're making 5, 10, 12%, whatever it is, but if the market dips 15%, well, you're still in the red, right? So anyway, so there's always some ups and downs to the staking side of things. I still think that there's, you know, you can be risk averse and just hold USDC. And then when the markets dip, you can buy back into Bitcoin or whatever you like and hope that it goes back up. And when it goes up, let's say Bitcoin goes back up to 60,000, well, then you could sell it again at 60,000 and then convert it back to USDC and just keep holding, right? So you could make a little bit of money that way, but you have to just make sure you're riding those waves correctly. So some other crypto news. I saw that Ripple or XRP, it's interesting. They've got the XRP coin, right? And they had all that litigation that happened with the SEC and about it being a commodity and whatever else it was. It was just quite the mess. After all that went away, XRP just really, I mean, it's never really skyrocketed, I wouldn't say. And, you know, everybody's like, oh, the SEC is going to shut them down. Well, they never did. And folks like MoneyGram and other places were actually using it for cross-border payments. Well, now, apparently, Ripple is coming out with their own stable coin, which should be interesting. They're saying within the next few weeks was what Brad Garlinghouse said. So I'll be interested to see, you know, how that works. Of course, they're going to say it's backed by the U.S. dollar and all the things that you're supposed to say. However, you know, we've seen like USDC, for example, I think it lost its dollar peg in 2023 sometime. So will it really be a stable coin? Will it really be backed by the US dollar? That's all yet to be seen, I guess. But I think this is actually a good move for, you know, Ripple. They've, you know, not really gotten anywhere with XRP. Plus, the general issue with crypto is the markets go up and down so much. If I send you $5 in Bitcoin right now, well, during that transaction, while it's being sent, which could take 45 minutes, the price of Bitcoin dips 30%, right? So now, instead of receiving $5, you're going to receive $4 and change, right? So this is where, you know, something that is a stable coin would be much more feasible, I think, and much more logical to, especially to do cross-border. That way you're not losing any money while the transaction goes through. They're also saying this is going to live on the Ethereum blockchain and their own XRP blockchain, which I find a little bit interesting as well. I'm not sure how all that's going to work. But regardless, I think this is the right move. And I think stable coins are, you know, for real world applications, I believe stable coins are much easier for people to wrap their heads around and understand that, oh, hey, the price of this isn't going to change every 2 seconds, right? So if I pay you $5, you're going to get $5, right? In some cases, I may pay you $5 in Bitcoin and then 5 minutes later, it's worth $10, right? So this is where, you know, having that stable currency that the price does not fluctuate, that can be a good thing, especially for cross-border payments and all that kind of good stuff. So I think this is actually good news for Ripple. I think this can actually help them quite a bit. But, you know, it's all yet to be seen because this isn't actually official yet, but he's saying within the next few weeks. So I would assume that means sometime in October of 2024, we should have a Ripple stablecoin backed by the US dollar. So we'll see. We'll see. It's good news for Ripple, and I think just good news in general for the actual application of, you know, cross-border payments and, you know, getting the money that you're actually sending, right? And be able to send the correct amount and not have that price fluctuate so bad. Also, too, according to Brad Garlinghouse, they've been testing this since August, which, you know, it's only been like a month, right? So they've been testing it with various business partners that they already do business with. This is Ripple. So yeah, I think it's great. I think it's, you know, again, I think it's going to be a good thing overall, but I'll be interested to see how it works on the Ethereum blockchain with the smart contracts, all that kind of interesting stuff. That's where I'm like, okay, what other applications could we have here? But I also don't know, you know, how you know, being on the Ethereum blockchain, would that affect the price? Those are kind of the things I'm scratching my head about a little bit. So anyway, in other news, there's apparently a Trump-backed crypto DeFi project in the works. Thought that was kind of interesting to hear about, especially given that he's running for president. But, you know, I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing. It's just kind of interesting more than anything. But the group that is creating this is called World Liberty Financial. And, yeah, anyway, it's going to be a DeFi project. type of crypto. So I guess we'll see how this all plays out. The details are a little bit scarce right now, I would say, on kind of what's happening here. But just interesting to see that a former president is getting in on the crypto world and trying to create their own DeFi. More to come on that, I'm sure. But it's just interesting to see a president getting involved in crypto, which maybe, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is good for the crypto community. If he does become president, then he's not going to try to, you know, shut the whole thing down. Not that that would be very successful anyway, but, you know, some presidents have said that they're going to, you know, they're going to tackle it. They're going to, you know, block it. They're going to shut it down, all these things. And it's never really happened because it's decentralized and it's hard to actually shut it down. So another general crypto stuff, I think we've already said that, you know, the price of Bitcoin is way down, and the jobs report that just came out announced a whole bunch of layoffs and fun stuff like that. So, and the feds are trying to cut rates, which may also affect the price. So just buckle your seatbelt, get ready. It may be a good buying opportunity, but again, this is not financial advice. I'm just giving my opinions on this. So it's all interesting and fun to kind of keep up with you. All right, folks, that's all I've got for today. Appreciate everybody listening, and we'll talk again next week.